What I don't know.
Meaning you will have to start with, right?
Good afternoon, the Senate Judiciary Committee will come to order. Members, we were planning to probably have to go a little bit beyond an hour and a half today anyway, and now with the later start because of session, you should anticipate going probably till around 2 o'clock or so, just for your own planning purposes, unless things surprise me, and which would be fine too, if we can go faster. For these bills that are on the agenda today, they all have a common theme, well, most of them have a common theme relating to DWI a law in one way or another. It's the chair's intent to lay each of them over today for possible inclusion in a possible omnibus DWI bill. There are still some other DWI bills that'll be coming forward for consideration by this committee, and then we'll have a chance at a subsequent hearing to consider all of them in the full context and decide what we'd like to do as a committee. We are going to make one adjustment in the order of the agenda to accommodate one of the witnesses' schedules. We're going to take Senate File 499, which is the Ignition Interlock Device Program Modification, first, and then we will revert back to the original order of the agenda. So with that, Senator Goodwin, if you come over to take over the chair, and we'll go ahead and start with Senate File 499.
It goes here and then goes here.
But we'll reverse this.
Okay.
Cool. Yeah.
Thank you.
I'll be back in a
second. Okay. That's right.
Let the record show that we now have a quorum.
Oh, really? Whatever.
How are you? Hi, Kramer. You let me know if I...
You know, you can sit at the table if you want, Mr. Chairman.
I don't want to hear this stuff.
Senator Latz, I believe you want to begin with Senate File 570, is that correct?
499, please.
499.
Yes, it is.
Okay.
You know him?
Senator Latz.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. This bill that you have before you utilizes the safety benefits of the Ignition Interlock Program that have been well documented in other forums as well as here, and extends those benefits to individuals whose vehicles are proposed for forfeiture as a consequence of their DWI-related conduct. I'll describe the bill very briefly, and then I'm going to ask Mr. Rogoszewski to testify in favor of it, as well as Lee McGrath. Basically, what happens if you are subject to certain kinds of DWI incidents, your vehicle may be subject to forfeiture. It is impounded, and it is locked up in an impound lot until the legal proceedings are concluded. And then it's determined after those legal proceedings are done whether or not they get resolved in such a way that you may be entitled to have the vehicle back or whether the vehicle is gone forever. What that does for many individuals and their families is deprive that individual or family of a vehicle. The bill, and there are consequences to that. And Mr. Roger, I'm not going to, say what he's going to say, I'm trying to avoid those consequences and enable those persons to get back driving on the road in a manner that is more safe than they otherwise would. And so what this bill does is it allows them to get their vehicle back right away if they agree to enter into the ignition interlock program and be subject to that program with the device installed in the vehicle they get back. So that's the gist of the bill, and I will ask Paul Rogaszewski then to testify in favor of it.
Thank you, Senator.
Welcome to the committee, Mr. Rogaszewski.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Members, my name is Paul Rogaszewski. I've been a lawyer for 36 years. I've been the president of the Dakota County Bar and the First Judicial District Bar, as well as the Ramsey County. I've been a member of the Ramsey County Bar, Washington County Bar. Practiced primarily in criminal defense. And prior to the ignition interlock, what we had is many people driving illegally because, as you know, public transportation isn't available all over the state. And what this bill does is it's really a public safety bill because it allows people to drive, and they drive safely because they're on the ignition interlock. And this has been a great program to allow people. But what usually happens is you usually have a family member or a loved one that commits the offense and then subjects the family to punishment. You'll have a situation where the husband gets a DWI, and now the family is strapped. They only have one car. They have to go out and buy another car. It's a big financial situation. You have a lot of people that are divorced, have to take care of their children, or they're driving their child's car, and that car becomes the subject of forfeiture and takes away that child's car and the ability to get to school after work or after school activities. So what this bill does is it provides public safety by allowing the people to drive, but drive safely on the ignition interlock, and they're monitored. The way the ignition interlock works is you're blowing constantly as you're driving. So if I drove here where our office is in South St. Paul in Senator Metzen's district, we'd probably blow about five or six times on the breathalyzer. You can't start your car unless you are blowing zeros. So this is a real public safety bill, and it would be extremely helpful, and it wouldn't detract from public safety. That's the main goal here, is to encourage people to drive legally. And what happens, especially outstate, when people get strapped, they do stupid things, and they drive illegally. So this helps them. The only thing I would suggest maybe on the bill is maybe to make it effective the day after passage. I mean, this bill is needed. I just came from court where I had two people where one couldn't take his child to work because they don't have a car and they're strapped financially. And the other one is a fellow that's in a divorce situation, and his vehicle is gone, and now he's going to have to spend $6,000-$7,000 to get another vehicle so he can take care of his kids on his weeks where they rotate on the weeks. So I encourage you to support this bill. I'd be happy to answer any questions that you might have.
Any questions from the members at this time? I guess not. Seeing none, Senator Latz.
Thank you. Let's make sure you sign in here. Lee McGrath is also desires to testify, Madam Chair.
Welcome to the committee, Mr. McGrath.
Madam Chair, thank you. My name is Lee McGrath. I'm the managing attorney for the Minnesota Office of the Institute for Justice. The Institute for Justice is a public interest law firm. We are the nation's leader in attempting to end civil forfeiture and replace it with criminal forfeiture. I thank Senator Latz for authoring this bill. It is good legislation. I encourage you to include it in a policy bill and ultimately enact it. Civil forfeiture, going up to 35,000 feet to discuss civil forfeiture, it is a failed public policy. It has failed in two ways. One is that it is not a successful deterrent to crime. It is mere punishment. And that has been recognized by our Supreme Court and the United States Supreme Court. And it is arbitrary punishment. The amount of the punishment varies by the type of property that is seized, and that is often disproportional to the crime. Secondly, forfeiture is animated by the fact that Minnesota like 48 other states, like many other states, chooses to allow the proceeds to supplement law enforcement's budget, thus establishing certain incentives to pursue some crimes versus other crimes. In Minnesota today, approximately 7,000 pieces of property are seized annually. About 4,000 of them are vehicles, and about 3,000 of them are related to DWI. So in other words, approximately 20 times a day, a Minnesotan is having his property seized. The good news is that Minnesota is a leader, thanks to the efforts of this committee under both Chairman Latz as well as his predecessors, including Chairman Waugh. Minnesota is leading the nation in taking steps to address some of the inherent problems that exist with civil forfeiture. Last year, Governor Dayton signed legislation that was unanimously supported by this committee and most members of the Senate to require a conviction as a prerequisite to losing one's property in civil court. That was important because no one who is acquitted of a crime should lose their property through civil forfeiture. This bill is another important step to addressing the inherent problems in civil forfeiture, and it does it in a very thoughtful way in which it gives an incentive to the property owner to avoid forfeiture, maintain his assets by installing a successful public policy device, the ignition interlock device. So I would encourage this committee and all members to continue Minnesota's efforts to advance property rights and due process rights by addressing forfeiture throughout the session and in particular this bill today. I'd be happy to answer any questions that members might have.
Any members have questions for Mr. McGrath? Not? Thank you very much for your testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chairman.
Sure to sign in.
Senator Latz, do you have any other people
Madam
to
Chair,
testify?
I don't have any other witnesses. I don't know if anyone else in the room wants to hear on this topic.
Is there anybody in the audience that wants to testify either for or against the bill? Well, seeing none.
Madam Chair, then if I could just make a closing comment or two, and then I'll ask to have it laid over. Madam Chair, this is a bill that would enhance public safety. What happens now is people, as Mr. Rogoszewski identified, if they lose their vehicle but they still want to keep their job and they have no other way to get to their job, or they want to get to the grocery store because they got to, you know, take care of their family, or whatever their urgent need is, they will find a way to get there, and they will drive, but they will drive illegally. They'll go out and spend $500 for what one representative or one advocate who was in my office earlier this year described as a bar car, a junker. They won't insure it. They won't have a valid license. But they're going to drive because they need to drive, because they're going to decide that it's worth the risk of getting caught driving illegally so they can keep their job. They'll set their priorities. And frankly, a lot of rational people would make that decision, even though they'd be knowingly committing a crime to do so. And the current structure of our laws sets up that conflict. So if we want people to be able to drive lawfully with insurance, with a valid license, and a vehicle, and to avoid the financial consequences, it's expensive enough to get a DWI in Minnesota without incurring the substantial financial penalty of losing the vehicle on top of it. Then we should link it to a demonstrated technology that enhances public safety, and that is the ignition interlock device. So that's the premise for this bill. And when we get to the point of considering it for final action, I would ask the members of this committee to support it. I will note with appreciation my co-authors on the bill, Senators Champion, Newman, and Thompson. So this is truly a bipartisan, well-thought-out and rational approach to public safety. So So with that, Madam Chair, I'd ask the bill be laid over for possible inclusion.
Okay, Senator Letts moves that we lay the bill over for possible inclusion in omnibus DWI bill. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion carries.
Yeah, we'll ask some questions on that.
We are now going to revert back to the original beginning of the agenda, Senate File 610, Senator Jensen, a necessity defense for implied consent court proceedings. Welcome to the committee, Senator Jensen.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. Senate File 610 was in direct response to a 2014 Minnesota Supreme Court decision, Axelberg versus the Commissioner of Public Safety. And what that case involved was a couple that they were at a lake cabin for the weekend, and they were drinking. So there was alcohol involved, and the husband physically assaulted his wife. He had her cell phone. She fled to their car and locked the doors. He proceeded to jump on the car and start breaking the windows and going after trying to get in through the windshield. Frightened, the wife drove away, fearing for her life. When she did, law enforcement became involved at that point, and the husband was arrested for domestic assault, and the wife was for driving while impaired. What the Supreme Court said in their decision was that because we do not have explicit information regarding necessity defense when it comes to the implied consent proceedings, that it would be up to the legislature to have to step in and provide some clarification on a situation like this. So the legislation that we put together and are bringing forward is very narrowly bringing the necessity defense into the civil implied consent proceedings when you try to present a necessity defense when you have lost your license, because you automatically get your license revoked when this type of situation occurs. It is very narrow, and it's directly tied to a limited circumstance when you're fleeing, when physical safety is threatened, and it is that you have to prove it overwhelmingly and that it leaves no alternative, in this situation where she had no phone and she had no way to contact anyone else. She felt she had no other recourse but to drive away. And I understand that this puts two public safety situations and issues into conflict with each other, which is why we're bringing this forward, to make sure that the judiciary has the ability to at least consider the necessity defense in this type of situation. I do have Liz Richards with me as well to answer some questions.
Ms. Richards, go ahead.
Yes, I'm Liz Richards, the director of the Minnesota Coalition for Battered Women. And you have the one-page sheet that we put together in your packet, which lays out the Axelberg case and the legislative proposal. The one thing that I would add is that one of the things that we did when looking at the Axelberg case is we talked with our programs across the state and also with some prosecutors to see how often this type of situation might present itself. And while it's a fairly rare situation, that what occurred in the Axelberg case, what we did here is it does on occasion occur. And it occurs primarily in isolated rural areas of the state where people have no other way to seek safety. And so, and we understand that these are competing public safety needs. We just are looking to see that when they do present in this fashion, that the authorities making the license revocation decisions have the ability to at least weigh a necessity defense in those rare situations when this does occur. And so we would ask for support of this legislative change.
Thank you. Are there any questions from the committee for Ms. Richards? Senator Newman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a quick comment for the benefit of the committee members. I have read the Axelberg case, and I will tell you that the circumstances that were outlined in terms of the facts were very unusual and very dangerous. The Court has very clearly indicated that that defense of necessity is not available unless the legislature gets involved. So we've got a very clear message from the Supreme Court. And under the circumstances of Axelberg, it's a very narrow interpretation. I think it's not going to be something that we're going to see very often. But when it does happen, this defense should be available. And I think this is an appropriate bill.
Senator Goodwin.
Just a quick question, and I think it's a great bill. I wanted to find out if the same if right now that somebody can use that defense if they don't have a driver's license or don't have insurance but need to get away, can they use that as a defense for those issues as well or not under current law?
Ms. Richards.
Chair and Senator Goodwin, I'm not quite sure I understand your question. Are you that there is not the necessity defense that it exists in the criminal setting is through the common law,
right?
And it's a defense to the under the criminal charges. So in the implied consent proceedings, this has to do with the very specific place where it says that if you test above the limit,
right,
with the license being revoked, that there is no. Because it's such a definitive list of ways in which you can challenge that license revocation, this change is only addressing that license revocation within the implied consent.
So to be clear, the implied consent proceeding is defined in statute, and the statute identifies just 10 areas of challenge that are authorized for the court to hear, and the Supreme Court in Axelberg concluded that there wasn't jurisdiction within the district courts to consider the necessity defense because it wasn't enumerated as one of those 10. And so this bill adds to the statutory enumeration the necessity defense so it can be heard.
Yeah.
And then the question is always, is it proven? But that's a separate question.
Well, Mr. Chair, I understand that, but what I'm asking is I guess I would want to make sure that if somebody has to escape an abusive situation, but they don't have a driver's license or they don't have insurance, that they could still not be penalized for driving if they were in a dangerous situation like that.
Senator Goodwin, I think the answer would be the necessity defense is a common law defense to criminal charges, so it could be raised in defense of a criminal charge for driving without a license. Mm-hmm. Or under those circumstances. But because the implied consent statute is a civil and legislatively created procedure, we need to address its inclusion legislatively.
All right, thank you.
All right, we have one other person that I know of that wished to testify, and that's Joel Watney. So we'll ask Mr. Watney to come forward. I will note Joel is a retired assistant attorney general, and in fact was, when I was there and for many years after that, the senior attorney in the Public Safety Division at the Attorney General's Office. Joel, you were a mentor to me in this field of law, so I appreciate your service and your public service with the AG for many years. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Since I am a retired assistant to the AG, I do not speak for the Attorney General's Office or any other state agency. I'm speaking purely as a private citizen who spent 37 years trying implied consent cases in all 87 counties of this state. And in that time, I did learn a little bit about how the system works and how legislation is interpreted or arguably interpreted in the trenches. This bill is basically an attempt to undo the Axelberg decision in which the Supreme Court gave express effect to the language of the statute limiting the scope of judicial to certain enumerated issues. That language in the statute is based in part on the decision of the United States Supreme Court in 1979 in Mackey versus Montrim, which upheld the Massachusetts implied consent law as satisfying due process, even though they had revocations first, review afterwards, and the hearings were administrative. Only three issues could be considered, and the burden of proof is on the driver in all of the three issues to show that, A, the officer did not have probable cause, B, he wasn't placed under arrest, or C, he did not refuse testing. That satisfied due process. Our statute has always allowed the DWI suspect to argue many more issues than that. And, of course, the members of the defense bar have tried to get around the statutory limitation and have had some judges willing to go along with them, that it didn't make any difference what restrictions this body placed on the scope of review. They were going to allow them to litigate anything they wanted. And this has taken up all sorts of judicial time, police witness time, prosecutor's time, court clerk's time, and whatnot, on litigation on things that were not properly before the courts. That includes the necessity defense, when the courts have said over and over again that it was not available in implied consent cases. I have personally tried an alleged necessity case in Faribault, where a motorcyclist from the Twin Cities has got in a fight, instigated a fight in a bar, and then when it looked like he was outnumbered, decided he had to get out of there. And he tried arguing the defense of necessity after he was warned by a police officer to walk his motorcycle away, and as soon as he didn't see the cop around anymore, jumped on the motorcycle and started it off. Case after case after case, we had to litigate whether or not there was a necessity defense and whether or not facts were shown. And usually the court said we didn't even have to reach the question of whether or not the defense was recognizable in implied consent cases because the facts would not support any criminal case. A more expansive version of this bill was presented to the DWI task force at its last meeting a couple weeks ago, and I see it's the second bill up on the legislature now, before you now. And the proponent made it quite clear that the concern was less about the Supreme Court's holding about the common law defense of necessity, but with the court's reasoning that the legislature can and has limited the scope of judicial review, and that this might lead trial courts to actually start enforcing the statute. In Axelberg, the Chief Justice noted that the driver argued that it is bad public policy to force victims of domestic abuse to choose between license revocation and personal safety. If you stop to think about it, I don't think that there's any person in this room who would seriously claim that persons in Ms. Axelberg's position would contemplate the driver's license consequences of their decision to drive. So we're not forcing people to make a choice between license revocation and personal safety. The bill proposes to place a higher priority on the private interest of an individual to retain a driver's license over the public interest in public safety. I believe this would be a very bad prioritization. First of all, we have a statutory presumption that applies throughout our case law that the legislature intends to favor the public interest as against any private interest. The sanction of a license revocation, particularly in light of the liberal limited license provisions in this state, is a relatively minor inconvenience compared with the risk of injury and death to innocent members of the public. One of the most difficult things I had to do on the job was to respond to citizen letters from people whose children had been killed by drunk drivers. They could sit at the keyboard for hours trying to come up with language that could be helpful to them. I remember one particular case arising out of Mankato where, for reasons that I don't know, the driver had been acquitted of criminal negligence. And the parents wrote to the AG's office basically asking that we go nail the SOB to the wall. Obviously, we couldn't do that. But I also had to try to come up with some words of comfort and suggestion that might help them. And it took hours. It's a very, very difficult task to respond to situations of that type. Now, the Supreme Court indicated that drawing priorities is for this body. That is absolutely true. But the risk to the public in general, I think, is such that we should not be making any change on this thing. Now, you've been told that the language is very narrowly construed or drafted. That may be the intent of the sponsors here, but that is not what the language says. The language in this bill, in fact, is broader than saying the defense of necessity available in criminal cases should apply in implied consent cases. That's not what it says. At the very end, it says that there would be a necessity based on a threat of personal injury or danger. Several of my former adversaries are here, and I can assure you that if this language were the law, they would be in court tomorrow telling the court how, well, it's going to be, you know, it's cold at night in Minnesota. Weather forecasters tell us it's going to be below zero tonight. My client left, was kicked out of the bar at bar closing time. He didn't have money for a cab. He had to sit in his car. And because it's cold, he had to start it up. Therefore, he should not be charged with being in physical control. It should be an excuse, necessity. This language would be argued as expansively as possible, and my former adversaries in the defense bar have exceedingly fertile imaginations in trying to expand language of this type. Now, I am not at all unmindful of the problem of battered women. My sister was one. She shed her first husband after he kicked her around with his Air Force Reserve boots on. He remarried, had a daughter and a son. And when the second wife decided she'd had enough and was going to leave, he shot her and killed her, shot their daughter and killed her, told his son to go off to grandma's house a few blocks away, and then shot himself, but with much less effect. He was sentenced to two life terms, and last time I checked with the Department of Corrections, this was a 1979 murder in Moorhead. Anybody here from Clay County will recognize who I'm talking about. He had a release date of 2079, and the last time I checked, he's on supervised release at St. Peter to some institution. I've been unable to verify exactly where. But when we're talking about the license consequences to a single individual versus the risk to the public, it seems to me that the scales are very easily balanced here, and it's in the public interest is by far the more important, and I would therefore request that this measure not be approved. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Watney. Are there any questions for Mr. Watney? All right. Thank you for your testimony. Is there anyone else who would like to be heard either for or against this bill? Senator Jensen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thanks to the testifier, too, for coming forward and talking about what the real issue is. How do we weigh out some of these things? And that's why we create the laws in the manner that we do, is to make sure that everybody has what they need in order to go through the system. What it pointed out to me is, in his testimony, that right now we do one over the other, and that someone in that situation doesn't have the ability to bring necessity forward when it comes to physical harm. And we did think that we need to do this very, very, very narrowly, and that it has to be, when you use necessity, it's on behalf of the defendant to prove, and it has to be overwhelming evidence that there, the cases that are out there, that if you have a cell phone and have another way to do it, they, you wouldn't be able to use that defense. So I want everyone to consider, too, that there is language. So this is, this happens when you also refuse to comply with the implied consent. And there's actually broader language for that defense if you refuse to do it, rather than when you do comply, come back with that you failed the test, and then you lose your license because of that. This isn't dealing with that part of law. This is dealing with the revocation. And I will never try to imagine what someone goes through their mind when they're faced with this kind of a situation. What I'm concerned with is, it does our, do our laws protect and make sure that we're giving, providing the opportunity for the defense that they should be, that they should have. So please take into consideration that the response to this from the Supreme Court clearly stated, as Senator Newman talked about, that for some reason we have provided an affirmative defense when you don't even comply with taking the consent to take the test, but we don't provide that if there happens to be a very rare, not common, but real situation when someone's in physical danger and has had alcohol in their system. So I think this is very, very important legislation, and hope that you consider enacting it.
Thank you, Senator Jensen. Senator Hall.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Jensen, or to Ms. Richards, in the example that you gave where somebody was being abused and took off drinking in a car, if they did kill someone in that process because of their drunken driving, could they use this defense, necessity defense, to get out of that?
Well, that's in the criminal side. Thank you, Mr. Chair. That's on the criminal side, and so I think common law would allow the necessity defense on the criminal side. This has to do specifically with the civil side when you're trying to portray a defense that it was necessary for you to do this because of the physical danger to yourself. And it's just added to the list of things. There were 10 specific things that you could use in that civil to try to get your license back. So the end result for that victim is they would lose their license, they would have increased insurance. I mean, that is the intent, to make it very difficult for people to make that decision, but to not allow the necessity claim for someone in that particular situation. The court was pretty clear that the legislature could step in and make that determination, and that's what this legislation would do.
Senator Sharon.
Yes. I didn't get the name of the last testifier. Could I have some assistance with that?
Joel Watney.
Watton?
Watney.
Watney.
W-A-T-N-E.
I have two questions. One for the author. Is there some place where there's a clarity of what the definition is for physical safety, or is it wide open to the imagination of the defense?
Yes.
As is, which I thought it sort of sounded like with Mr. Watney.
Sure.
Was it Mr. Watney or Judge Watney?
Mr. Chair.
Mr. Watney.
And
Mr. Watney. Okay, thank
Mr.
you.
Mr. Chair and Senator Sharon.
Senator Jensen.
Ms. Richards would like to respond to that.
Ms. Richards.
Thank you, Chairman Latson. Senator, the language is not specifically defined within the statute itself in terms of the actual language, but where the court would look would be to common law. And the common law is very clearly been established around the necessity defense and the criminal charges, and the court would look to there. And what it says is that you have to show an emergency situation where peril is instant, overwhelming, and leaves no alternative. And if you look at the case law that's been developed around that, it's essentially that very narrowly construed within that case law. And so while it's not specifically defined within the statute itself, within the common law, it would be.
Thank you. And may I have another
Senator
question?
Senator Sharon.
Thank you. Mr. Watney, could you help me, as you spend time thinking about this, why you think if this, since this is already in law for criminal cases, why you would restrict it from civil cases? Why, if it's already in existence, which is an essence of what we've been asked to consider here, it's in one place it's already included, and this is simply extending into civil cases. Why wouldn't we do that?
Mr. Watney.
First, the language here is not limiting it to the criminal defense, the necessity defense as defined in criminal cases. Where the language is where you use statutory language, that's going to control over common law. And a defense attorney is going to say, aha, here the legislature says a necessity based on threat to physical safety, that's all I have to show. You don't have to show that they're in any way blameless, that there's no other possible alternative, any of the elements of the criminal, really the defense in the criminal case. So this is far broader and could be used to argue everything, like the hypothetical I gave you of the guy who decides he's going to sleep it off in the parking lot rather than drive home. And I have had a guy in Plainview, Minnesota, who lived one block from the bar and drove home and got caught.
Okay. Just delete that last provision.
Impaired drivers have impaired judgment, and they make absolutely bad choices all the time. And there's really no reason to increase the opportunities for them to avoid the consequences of their misconduct.
So, Mr. Watney, if we were to eliminate the reference to physical safety threat that's proposed in the bill before us, would it be your judgment then that the courts would revert back to the common law definition and would probably construe it more narrowly?
If the language at the very bottom of that subparagraph 8H was eliminated completely and you had only the other one, the defense of necessity, then I would assume that they would be applying the criminal standards.
Or, for example, if Section 8, if we just put a period after the word necessity and deleted the rest, would it not have the same effect?
Yeah, but it would be then kind of redundant because you already have that in Part N11.
All right.
At 2.19.
Thank you. Senator Sharon, did you have a follow-up?
I think you're getting at what I'm trying to understand, that on the one hand, I'm hearing, and without knowing everything that's in the law, that this privilege or this defense is allowed in one circumstance and not another. And there's concern about how this is written, that it opens some floodgates to shenanigans in the courtroom. And so is there a way to narrow it down to accomplish the objective and also be responsive to what you probably would know better than I would, is whether it's a valid consideration in terms of how this is being written.
Senator Jensen.
Mr. Chair and Senator Sharon, as long as we have the number 11 added to the bill that says, did the person prove the defense of necessity, I think that that does meet the ability for them to incorporate a necessity defense in their claim, and that number H probably
could be
eliminated. I'm comfortable with that.
I would make that motion that we would
Senator Sharon
would eliminate H under subdivision. Is it 11? Subdivision 11 on page 3, lines 2.34 and 2.35.
I'm going to ask counsel to offer some insight onto the drafting question here.
Mr. Chair, members, the proponents of the bill did want to have both references on 2.19 and then new paragraph H on 2.34. If you look at 2.20 paragraph C into current law, you'll see there's already one affirmative defense specified. I guess I would suggest, you know, leaving paragraph H, perhaps amending it if you wanted to put the period after necessity if you were concerned about the based on. And then if you were going to delete one or the other, I would suggest deleting the 2.19. Mm. Now, the next bill that you're going to hear, Senator Champion's bill, adds a lot of affirmative defenses, and they chose not to add the new paragraph, clause 11. So I don't know what other people think about that, but I think at least one DWI attorney thought that it wasn't necessary to add the clause 11 if you have the essentially the paragraph H.
Senator, I'm willing to modify my amendment to achieve the objective, and the, whatever language does that is what I would be willing to move forward.
Okay. Well, what I'm hearing Mr. Backus suggest is that the amendment be on line 2.34, after necessity, add a period, delete the rest of the language on that line, and delete line 35. Senator Newman, did you have a comment on that?
Just a thought. It sounds like the committee is heading in the direction of utilizing the defense of necessity on the basis of criminal law. Implied consent is not criminal. I can't envision situations in which defense of necessity might be something other than, say, a domestic. So it's pretty up to the committee as to what, you know, what definition do you want to apply to the defense of necessity. And to me, there's a difference between criminal and civil law. You are heading in the direction of applying only in the instances of a criminal violation. And I just wanted to just raise the flag and make you aware of the fact that there may be instances where a necessity would arise under the statute, you know, involving implied consent that is civil rather than criminal. I'm not at all sure that would necessarily agree that there are no circumstances under which defense of necessity for purposes of implied consent could never be raised. I'm not too sure what that might be. Perhaps it is a stalled vehicle at 30 below in the middle of winter in January. Maybe that would be a necessity to save someone's life. Supreme Court case and under current Minnesota law, you can't raise that defense. Implied consent is really an important area of law because, you know, you lose your driver's license. So I just urging you to think it through before you just apply it to criminal defenses. I just wonder if it would be applicable to something other than criminal actions.
And Mr. Chair?
Senator Goodwin.
I agree, and it seems to me like if we take out 3.4 and 3.5, then we really open it up to a defense of a number of kinds of necessity rather than just public safety or personal safety, physical safety. It's open for a number of other things that somebody might claim are necessary for them to drive while impaired. Is that correct? I mean, it seems to me like if you don't have in there restricted to physical safety, then you're opening it up to a number of other things that people might call necessity.
Senator Newman.
All we're really talking about is a fact. The fact finder is going to make this decision. The judge is going to make this decision.
Right.
And
I think we should leave it.
It just seems to me, you know, if it's a legitimate defense to the criminal charge where potentially you could go to jail, it ought to be a legitimate defense to the license revocation
right.
as well.
That's right.
And the case law has already defined it pretty narrowly. One example that was given, if you participated in the creation of the necessity, you're not entitled to use necessity defense in defense of your actions either. I mean, so that's just one of the permutations that limits the application of necessity defense in whatever situation it's being used. So it's a pretty narrow defense anyway. Given what Ms. Richards described as sort of the broader, the parameters that are put around it, the peril must be instant, immediate, and overwhelming.
you know, I've got some confidence in the judges who are hearing these cases to sort of judge the circumstances as they will be. And the other thing is that in criminal cases, the prosecutors have broad discretion to take into consideration the circumstances. They may offer a lesser charge for a conviction. They might have offered, they might have dismissed it altogether, or offered a careless driving or some other kind of a criminal charge to the woman defendant in Axelbert. I don't know how the case played out, but we could probably ask the lawyer who was involved, who's in the audience. The civil license revocation typically does not have that level of discretion on the part of the Attorney General's office that's prosecuting it. So I think it's important that we add a delineation if we can here. Members, I'm going to add, you know, we can noodle with this now, too, but we are going to have another opportunity to focus on specifics of language if we want to when the bill comes back.
I'll withdraw my amendment.
Somebody else can offer it. Who knows what they're talking about? Doesn't sound like
well, so, Senator Sharon, you wish to withdraw your amendment at this time, or did you want to strike the based on a threat to physical safety from the language? And then the necessity defense would be essentially as interpreted under common law. That would be the definition that would be utilized by the courts.
I'm afraid I've gotten confused by the conversation. I thought that that created a problem, according
to Senator
Newman.
I think
the
language in the bill creates the problem. The reference to physical safety appears to
be what's creating the problem. Then I'd be happy to, if the objective is met by removing on line 2.34 all language after necessity.
So Senator Sharon moves on line 34 to add a period after necessity, delete the rest of the line, and delete line 35. Second. Seeing a bunch of heads nodding here. All those in favor of Senator Sharon's amendment, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. Amendment's adopted. Any further discussion on Senate File 610?
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Senator Jensen. All right. Senate File 610 will be laid over for possible inclusion in an omnibus bill. Senate File 562, Senator Champion.
Senator, what is this?
Sort of a continuation of the same framework of discussion.
That was all very confusing.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members. It's true that the bill before us that was authored by my good friend Senator Jensen is this bill before you is a continuation of that important discussion. So let me frame it this way, that Minnesota's DWI laws permit the state to prosecute people in criminal court and also revoke their driver's license in civil court under the implied consent law. Either record will have essentially the same effect. So to effectively defend against a DWI accusation, a driver must prevail twice, both in the criminal context as well as the implied consent context. So under current law, drivers are permitted to raise an affirmative defense in their criminal prosecution that the alcohol in their system was from drinking after they drove, or that the controlled substance in their system was pursuant to a doctor's prescription. These defenses are not available in the implied consent law. Similarly, they may raise an affirmative defense in an implied consent case that they refuse to submit to a test based on reasonable grounds, but not in the companion criminal case. As you've already heard, and I mentioned this earlier, the Minnesota Supreme Court recently ruled that even though a woman could raise as a defense to her DWI criminal charge that she drove solely out of necessity to escape an intimate assault, that defense was not available in the companion implied consent case. So this legislation would make it clear that the legislature intends that these defenses are defenses to certain behaviors, regardless of the arena in which the person is litigating. This would not add or change defenses or change the burden of proof, but simply make the defenses available in both arenas. And I believe judges have the ability to look at the facts and determine if it's appropriate. Additionally, under current law, an accused person has only 30 days, so this is the other change that we're asking for, that I'm proposing, under current law, an accused person has only 30 days to appeal license revocation, but often is not given a hearing within that time. So the proposed legislation would increase the time to appeal to 60 days. That is the same as it is in a vehicle forfeiture law. So today I have with me Ryan
Pasiga.
I told him that I was probably going to mess up his name and that he would have to correct me again, an experienced criminal defense attorney. In fact, Mr. Pasiga was the attorney who represented Ms. Axelberg in the case all the way to the Minnesota Supreme Court. So I'm happy to have him here, and he has some insight that he'll be happy to provide for you, and he will provide more detail about the information about the changes I've described. We'll also walk through the bill language and can answer any questions about the impact these changes will have. So before he begins, I have an author's amendment, and this amendment was suggested by a member of the DWI task force when the bill was presented to that group. It simply makes the language more precise and true to its intent. So I offer the A1 amendment, Mr. Chair.
Members, you have the A1 amendment in your packets, a technical amendment and an author's amendment. So all those in favor of the A1 amendment, say aye.
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 Opposed? Motion prevails. Amendments adopted.
And now that the bill is in the shape I would like for it to be in, if we could have some testimony as well as walk through the bill with Mr. Pasiga.
Thank you. Welcome to the committee, Mr. Pasiga.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Ryan Pasiga, and I am primarily a criminal defense attorney. I've been practicing for 12 years. I'm a life member of the National Association of Criminal Defense Lawyers, as well as a member of the Minnesota Association of Criminal Defense Lawyers. And I am here on not only Ms. Axelberg's behalf, but also as a member of the Legislative Committee of the Minnesota Association of Criminal Defense Lawyers. I'm a father. I'm a husband. I am a son of a woman that was herself a victim of domestic abuse during my early childhood. I have Ms. Axelberg's support, and she thanks you for this opportunity as well. I think, given that there was earlier discussion with respect to the necessity defense, I have some clarifications that I would like to offer with respect to the last bill, because they carry into this bill, at least the necessity portion, if that's okay. And also I'll mention that we support the earlier bill as well. With respect to the necessity defense, as proposed in the implied consent legislation through the bill that's before you that I'm speaking about today, just some general comments. First, the necessity defense. I've practiced for 12 years. I've worked on over 1,000 DWI cases in my 12 years. And prior to the Axelberg case, I had raised the necessity defense only one other time, and it didn't make it out of the district court. I think that's important, because this defense is a very narrow defense in common law, and it's tough to get over. It's more difficult to prove for the defense than the self-defense defenses out there. And that's because, by virtue of the elements that exist in the common law for the necessity defense, as Chair Latz already discussed, number one, you can't create the necessity yourself. Second, under the common law elements, if the danger, the court must weigh the danger to the public included in the danger that the victim is trying to escape. And if the danger to the public outweighs the danger that the victim was facing, they do not succeed with the necessity defense. And I think that's important. So earlier there was a question, for example, well, what if you drive and you kill somebody? There, I have all the confidence in the world that a court would say that created a big danger to the public. In fact, you killed somebody, and therefore your decision to escape a domestic violence situation where there was a chance of physical injury or perhaps serious injury even, but not death, would be outweighed by the death, in fact, you caused on the road. So there are some limiting elements already within our common law necessity scheme. In addition to that, there are more consequences to somebody than a simple temporary license revocation, as Mr. Watney pointed out, that's just the beginning. What really happens if somebody picks up an implied consent violation and they do not either challenge it because they miss it by beyond 30 days or because they do not succeed on the merits in the district court, is that they're barred from going into Canada. When Canada looks at whether you can come in or not, they don't only look at your criminal record. If you have a license loss on your driving record, which they do look up, you can't come in unless you go through their protocol and have some exceptions met and pay some fees. People lose their jobs. Many people have to drive not only to work, but they have to drive as a function of their work. And I'm not talking about just people with commercial driver's licenses. I'm talking about pizza delivery drivers. I'm talking about salesmen that have to drive their own car or a company car. If they have an implied consent revocation, even if they're cleared in the criminal case, they lose their job and what happens to their family. Higher insurance rates. If there is a prior by chance, now we're looking at a situation where we're dealing with a longer revocation. We're dealing with it an enhanced DWI if they pick up another one in the future or if they had one in the preceding 10 years. And it could lead to vehicle forfeiture and those other sorts of things. So please don't be misled into the belief that, well, it's just simply a 90-day revocation, and no matter what, that's worth paying the price from someone having a drunk driving on the road to save themselves from an episode of domestic abuse. What's even more important to note is that as rare as this situation is, and the Axelberg situation, it kind of played out like a horror movie. I mean, here she was in the woods with her husband. They had done the responsible thing and walked 8/10 of a mile to the tavern in this remote location, drank there, got into an argument while they were walking back. He had her cell phone in his pocket. The cabin didn't have a landline, and there weren't any other cabins around in the area that she could run to. He's bigger, faster, stronger, so she could not outrun him. And the officer testified this was the only place she could go when she drove to that tavern. There was nowhere else that she could go to, because if she did have another alternative, the necessity defense would not have applied to her under common law. So if this is happening right outside here in St. Paul, you can't say, well, I get to drive to the police station to do this. There are cars driving by. There are other buildings. There are pedestrians. You have a cell phone. You don't make it with necessity because of that. But getting back to Axelberg, what's interesting is that what she did to get away from her husband after he started to push her and then punched her is she got into her car and simply locked the doors. She did not start the car or even put the keys in the ignition at that point in time. Under our current implied consent law, she is in what's called physical control of that automobile at that point in time. For the commissioner to revoke your license and give you an implied consent revocation and all of the other consequences that I talked about, they don't have to only prove that you've been driving the vehicle. They don't even have to prove that you've been operating the vehicle, which means sitting in it while it's running. All they have to prove is that you're sitting in the driver's seat and you either have the keys in your pocket or they're in the glove box or in the console. That's physical control. You don't even have to intend to ever drive the car at that point in time. So under our current law, without the necessity defense, Miss Axelberg actually had no remedy the minute she got into that car and locked the doors. She was already done for because she was in physical control of the motor vehicle at that point in time. And the court couldn't give her a remedy if they wanted to give it. So it extends much more beyond what Mr. Watney was talking about, and I wanted to make you aware of that. When her husband got onto the windshield, when she locked the doors, he next got onto the hood of the car. And while he was right above her, face to face, as she's sitting in the behind the driver's wheel, he's on the hood and he's punching the windshield, and he shattered it this big right in front of her. And then and only then did she put the keys into the ignition and start the car. And he stayed on the car and continued to punch it when she did that, even as she was backing up. And only when she put it into drive did he hop off of the car. And the next thing he did was he chased her on foot that 8/10 of a mile while she was driving the car back to that place of safety where another man had to intervene and save her from a second attack he attempted to carry out. And when police arrived, they charged him with domestic assault, and the officer charged her with DWI. And then the battle began in the implied consent arena. She was not convicted of DWI in criminal court, but the battle continued on in the district court. And the district court judge ruled the necessity defense is not even available in an implied consent proceeding because there is only one affirmative defense listed in our statutory scheme of implied consent. That is what's called reasonable refusal. And therefore, because they've mentioned the legislature when it created this law, when they mentioned one affirmative defense, under the rules of statutory construction, that means they've intentionally excluded all other defenses. So they said it's not available, the district court did, and we went up on appeal to the Minnesota Court of Appeals, and they said the same thing. Now, Mr. Watney's talked a couple times about, well, there have been other cases raised where people have tried to raise necessity. He's right, and in fact, I'm aware of at least two Minnesota Court of Appeals decisions pre-Axelberg that addressed the necessity question. And they said, well, it's never been ultimately decided whether necessity is available in implied consent proceeding. We don't even need to go there because just on the elements of necessity itself, these cases don't make it. So there's a great deal of gatekeeping being done in our district courts and appellate courts on the merits of necessity itself. But I think what's important and what's been discussed is we got to give a judge a chance. We've got to give these domestic abuse victims and other victims of violence or an attempted rape or whatever a chance to have a judge weigh the gravity of their situation and the peril they're facing against the peril that they would cause by driving drunk to the nearest safe location if that is truly their only alternative, and give a judge an opportunity after hearing that evidence to make that decision, and it still has to pass muster with the common law elements of necessity. And that's what we're asking for with respect to necessity. And after the Minnesota Court of Appeals says we can't do anything about it, it doesn't exist, we went up to the Minnesota Supreme Court, and in a 4-3 decision with a heated dissent, we find ourselves here today. And finally, I disagree with the characterization of what the Minnesota Supreme Court said in the Axelberg case, as Mr. Watney offered to you. What I would tell you is that a fair reading of that case says this implied consent law is a product of legislative creation. We, as a court, are not here to meddle with legislative creation. This is a product of the legislature. If they want to fix it, they need to do it. That's what they said. Even the Attorney General, the Assistant Attorney General, who argued at the Minnesota Supreme Court, when the question was put to him, what if your mother was in Ms. Axelberg's situation? What would you tell her to do? He said, I'd tell her to drive myself. There was no remedy for her. I did that case pro bono from day one, and I want to see it through. Obviously, I feel strongly about it, and if there's any questions on necessity, I would respectfully propose that I answer those before I move on to the other elements of the bill.
Senator Newman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Could you, and I don't mean to put you on the spot, but off the top of your head, could you recite for us the various elements of the common law doctrine of necessity?
Mr. Pasiga, you're on the spot.
Mr. Chair, Senator, I can't, but my iPhone can.
Thank you.
I tried to pull up my bill because or my brief from that case so I could go through each of the elements for you, and so I'll scroll to that if I can have a quick moment. All right. If I may.
Mr. Pasiga.
Necessity is an affirmative defense if the harm that would have resulted from compliance with the law would have significantly exceeded the harm actually resulting from the defendant's breach of the law. And then later the Supreme Court qualified that and even said potentially resulting rather than actually resulting from the breach of the law. And I think that's important because that further limits the necessity. The defense is applied only in emergency situations where the peril is instant, overwhelming, and leaves no alternative but the conduct in question. In order to establish the necessity defense, one must show that, one, there was no legal alternative to breaking the law, two, the harm to be prevented was imminent, and three, there was a direct and causal connection between breaking the law and preventing the harm. Necessity is unavailable as a defense if the choice of action is necessitated by recklessness or negligence. The defendant could have avoided the emergency by taking advance precautions or by advance preparation, or the defendant knowingly placed himself in a prohibited position merely because to commit the act would be more convenient, which is kind of creating the necessity.
Mr. Pasiga, why don't you go on to the other points of the bill, please?
Thank you, Chair. Okay, so essentially summarizing the bill before you, Sections 1, 4, and 6 propose to amend the challenges for hunting privileges being lost during a hunting while impaired, as well as to allow persons challenging the loss of impoundment to file a petition rather than 60, or to file their implied consent petition in 60 days rather than the current 30 days. And there's a couple reasons for that. One, it brings it into parity with our current forfeiture law. If you have 60 days to challenge a forfeiture from a drunken driving case, you ought to have the same time frame to file an implied consent challenge. Second, there are some savvy city or county attorneys out there that once the police arrest someone and seek to charge them with a DWI, if it's a breath test, for example, what law enforcement does as soon as that breath test result is had, which is right at the police station, they will issue them what's called a notice and order of revocation telling them that their license is being revoked and that they have 30 days to act on this. The language isn't as clear as I pointed out. It's sort of a confusing piece of paper all by itself. But at any rate, some city or county attorneys are savvy to this, and rather than also send criminal charges right away, which then triggers a defendant to go get a lawyer, they'll wait until that 30-day period on the license revocation filing time expires. And maybe they'll send him a criminal complaint 45 or 60 days later. And we get calls like that from people, and they say, hey, I'm being charged with a DWI. Will you defend me? And our first question is, well, when did it happen? 45 days ago, whatever. Oh, well, you're already too late to file your implied consent challenge. So no matter what happens on your implied consent or your criminal case, whether it be lowered to a careless driving or thrown out because it turns out there was an unconstitutional stop or the evidence was bad or whatever you have you, they don't have a remedy in the implied consent proceeding because they've missed their time. And no matter what happens then, that counts as a prior DWI conviction against them for a 10-year period. It's enhanceable, and we get into those other problems with the potential job loss, economic factors for the family, and so forth. So what we're trying to do is give people enough time to make a valid challenge. The courts are still the gatekeepers on these things, but it's the swiftest statute of limitations in Minnesota law. That is a very tight time frame. And affording them an extra 30 days on top of what's already there gives them 2 months in order to get their ducks in a row, sometimes put their finances together in order to even get legal counsel so that they can file a challenge because the judicial remedy requires a filing fee of nearly $400 to even file one of these things, and it's very difficult for a pro se person to file a meaningful petition for judicial review and challenges implied consent hearings. So it gives them more time and brings it into parity with the forfeiture law.
Mr. Pasiga, I'll just add one other example. I serve on a panel in district courts in Hennepin County where I give free legal advice to persons that come into the arraignment courts. And even when they have a breath test and they get the citation and a court date right away from the police officer so they know, those court dates aren't often within the first 30 days. So they may show up 45 or 60 days later in court for the first time. And that my first question is always the same thing. When did it happen? And half the time I have to tell them, well, you should have read that sheet a little bit more carefully and hired a lawyer right away because now you've missed your implied consent deadline. So it's not even prosecuting attorneys playing games with the system, if you will. It's just the ordinary course of courts having congestion and being scheduled more than 30 days out for that first court appearance before they really start to pay close attention. So go ahead, Mr. Pasiga.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. With respect to Section 2, what that seeks to do is to expand the affirmative defenses in hunting cases to make those in line with the criminal DWI affirmative defenses as well, and also to apply that to motorboat and snowmobile or all-terrain sorts of DWI situations. So essentially, we have this problem right now, as you've heard, where on the criminal case, if a defense exists under common law, but it's not mentioned in our current implied consent statutory scheme, you have this confusion where a client comes to us and says, well, wait a minute, I thought you said this is a defense, or the court gave me a remedy in this criminal case, but I can't even raise it over in the implied consent proceeding. And so it seeks to bring them in line and make those same affirmative defenses that are available in the criminal arena available in the implied consent arena. These are just affirmative defenses that can be raised. They still have to succeed on the merits, but in a sense, it's a little perverse that you can raise this, that you can have the same behavior. I'll give you an example, prescription drugs. Right now, you can be allegedly under the influence of prescription drugs in a criminal case, and that is an affirmative defense, and this is happening more and more, perhaps with a more proliferation of prescription medication, where we have people who are arrested, they're given a blood test, and there's prescription drugs, and lo and behold, it's within normal limits, and that resolves in the criminal case. That's an affirmative defense for them. But you take that over to the implied consent law right now, and the defenses can't even be raised. A court cannot even consider that. So these people who are vindicated by virtue of taking their medications as directed, if they're not taking them as directed, they can't use the defense. But that's a defense right now in the criminal arena, but it's not in parity with the civil law. And what this bill really seeks to do is to bring these two laws more in parity with each other. Because I believe that there are situations that the legislature, when it created our implied consent law, and we were the first state in the nation to have one, I think that the legislature back then didn't foresee some of these issues, because nobody can imagine all of the possibilities that could happen. A very important one, for example, is post-driving consumption. That means that if police get a call that maybe you're weaving within your lane and some other motorist thinks, well, there's a drunk driver in front of me, and they call police, and you get home, and that person says, hey, they just pulled into their driveway, they're in their garage, they've gone in their home, and they stay on the line with 911, and police show up, and they knock on your door, and the driver comes out, what's going on? Maybe police get there a half hour later or an hour later sometimes, depending on the rural community or the weather conditions or while there are higher priority emergencies police have to attend to. Well, they get to the door, and you haven't drank before you drove. Maybe somebody was texting or looking at their phone or whatever, and that was the cause of the weaving. You have a right right now under the criminal law to raise what's called post-driving consumption. And if you can prove, and it's tough to prove, but if you can prove that indeed the drinking happened at home, maybe there's a witness, your spouse is there, and they said, we were out to dinner, he didn't drink anything because he doesn't drink and drive, but when we rode home, he just had two glasses of wine. Law enforcement arrests him and takes a test, and now he's over the limit. He's a .08 or a .09. If you can prove to a court that you're drinking, your blood alcohol level is actually a cause of after you drove, not before you drove, the truly innocent person that our appellate courts talk about, that's a defense called post-driving consumption. I consumed the alcohol or I consumed the prescription drugs after I drove. But that remedy isn't available in our implied consent law right now. I can't imagine that the legislature, when it created this law, and I think if I remember right, it was in the late 60s, ever imagined, even thought of that scenario happening. It's just something that probably escaped their imagination at the time. Or I believe they would have included that as an affirmative defense in our implied consent law, post-driving consumption, because you're not really seeking to penalize the truly innocent driver who did not consume any alcohol or prescription medication before they drove. And this bill seeks to fix those sorts of scenarios that have come up over time that we can identify with cases and say, hey, these sort of things aren't working under our law, and we want to bring it into parity with the criminal law so someone can at least raise that defense and have a judge who is the gatekeeper in these cases make that determination. And these implied consent cases don't go to juries. They only go to judges, and they have the trained legal minds to deal with these situations. They're not the type to act upon or more as susceptible to act upon, for example, emotion as a jury might be. So we're dealing with a trained judicial officer to make these determinations in implied consent proceedings. With respect to Section 3, this seeks to specifically add the necessity defense, which is, for lack of a better term, I call it the Axelberg Amendment, in response to the Axelberg decision, which said, again, legislature, you created this law. If you think it should apply, you need to put it in there. This is your law, not ours. And then, in addition to that, it brings into parity the post-driving consumption, for example, and the other affirmative defenses, like for the test refusal crime. Now, this is the backwards part of it. In the implied consent law right now, the only affirmative defense is what's called reasonable refusal. What would be an example of a reasonable refusal to a request for a test? Well, one thing is, for example, religious beliefs. If somebody has a true and valid religious belief that their religion doesn't allow for them to have blood withdrawn from their body or give a bodily fluid as a sample, blood or urine, for example. If they have a legitimate religious belief about that, that can be construed as a reasonable refusal. Now, the officer could offer them breath at that point, and if that doesn't violate their religion, then that defense wouldn't apply. But the point is that's an example of reasonable refusal that is an affirmative defense right now under the implied consent law. Another one could be that you have asthma, you're trying to blow into the machine, and the officer says, well, you're not giving a good enough sample, I'm going to call it a refusal. The machine says you're not giving enough deep lung air here, you're not blowing the required volume of breath, I'm determining that this is a refusal. You ought to be able to raise it and say, look, I tried to blow, I was telling the officer I tried to blow, I can't give enough, I was telling him or her, I'm willing to give you my blood or urine. I can't blow hard enough. You're telling me to blow. I can't. But I'm not refusing. I want to give you blood or urine. Right now, the officer has control over that. And if they only offer breath, you're out of luck. In the criminal case, you can't say this is a reasonable refusal right now. So on that point, it's a parity thing. But instead of putting what's already exists in the criminal to the implied consent, we're also asking you to take the one affirmative defense implied consent that doesn't occur yet in the criminal case and say, let's put these in line with each other. It also amends the current drug, prescription drug affirmative defense, as I touched on earlier. And it provides a fairness element, and that is that if a litigant in an implied consent or in a criminal case wants to raise this affirmative defense, the litigant cannot do that unless prior notice is given to the opposing party, which puts them on notice because the other side on these cases needs to be able to respond to these defenses, and if they have notice, they can accordingly respond to it, and then you get the best hearing in front of a court when both sides are prepared to vigorously advocate their cause. If they're on notice about it, they're not being ambushed with it, and then hopefully when both sides are prepared and doing their job, justice will shake out in the end.
So, Mr. Vasiga, before you go on, let members of the public and the audience know that we are not going to consider item 5 on the agenda today, the default misdemeanor bill, since we're spending our time on these other bills, and I don't want to keep the committee any longer once we complete the DWI stuff. So for those of you who have been here anticipating that bill, sorry to make you wait for so long, but I don't want to keep you any longer than I have to. So we'll reschedule that for another time. Mr. Pasiga, you can go ahead, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Section 5 is more in line with the affirmative defenses again, but then also and importantly, it provides that any constitutional challenges are properly within the scope of an implied consent hearing. I'll tell you a brief story. About a decade ago, I was in front of a judge on an implied consent hearing, and I challenged whether a city ordinance was actually constitutional. It was the basis for the stop, the traffic stop in the first place. And the judge said, well, that's not one of the 10 elements that you can challenge in an implied consent case, so I can't even consider that. And I said, wait a minute, Judge, are you telling me, let's say, for example, that a city had an ordinance that said, minorities can't drive after 10 p.m. Hold with me. I know it's an extreme example, but hold with me. minorities have to be off the roads by 10 p.m. in our city. Well, that's clearly an unconstitutional ordinance. I said, but Judge, are you telling me that if my client was pulled over simply for being a minority after 10 p.m. in a situation where a city has an ordinance that's that patently unconstitutional that I can't even raise that as an implied consent challenge? And he said, yeah, that's what I'm telling you. So I know it's an extreme example, but the point is that there ought, constitutional challenges ought to be able to be raised in these implied consent proceedings, because if, as happens from time to time, an officer goes over the bounds of what our Constitution allows in the purpose of a traffic stop or those sorts of things, a judge ought to be able to rein that in and handle that in an implied consent hearing. Otherwise, we have that same situation that we have in the criminal cases. The criminal case evidence is suppressed because we, in America, we value our constitutional rights, and we say that if the evidence is gotten by a constitutional preceding constitutional violation, then it's fruit of the poisonous tree, and that's thrown out. So this says, hey, you should be able to make constitutional challenges. And if a judge agrees with that challenge and this evidence was the fruit of the poisonous tree, then we ought to be able to have that heard by a judge. And that also would bring it in line with the criminal law. The Section 7... Oh, I'm sorry. Back to Section 5, one other thing. It also expands the scope of the hearing to allow a judge to determine whether the offender was, in fact, driving, operating, or in physical control of the motor vehicle. Right now, that's kind of a technicality in our implied consent law. It just says if an officer has probable cause to believe. So the probable cause standard is certainly okay enough for an arrest, but we require more evidence than that in a criminal case, proof beyond a reasonable doubt, and we're not proposing to bring the standard, the standard of proof that's required in implied consent hearings, which is much lower, it's preponderance of the evidence, but instead get beyond just probable cause to believe, because if an officer only has probable cause to believe you're in physical control, if they're wrong about that and you weren't in physical control, under the implied consent law, you can't say, but that's not right. I only get to challenge probable cause, and that's such a low standard. So there's that gray area between probable cause and the required burden of proof right now, which is preponderance of the evidence. What this seeks to do is not just have an end-all and be-all to the hearings right at probable cause for that question, but rather get it up to the level that's required for the rest of these issues in the implied consent law, which is preponderance of the evidence. Section 7 makes the same substantive changes to the criminal vehicular operation law as are being made in the DWI criminal law regarding the affirmative defenses. So it brings these affirmative defenses also into the criminal vehicular operation law. But the defense relating to test refusal is not included because currently that's not an offense under our criminal vehicular operation law. As an aside, the Minnesota Supreme Court issued a big decision yesterday called Bernard, which overhauls our test refusal law right now and holds it up as a constitutional law. So that might affect some things going forward. That's up to you to decide. Section 8 prohibits a court from construing the bill as addressing or limiting the applicability of affirmative defenses in other criminal or civil proceedings. So what it really does is clarify that we're talking about our criminal DWI law and our civil implied consent law with respect to DWI hunting violations and the arena that I've talked about today. But it doesn't knock out other affirmative defenses in other areas of law. I think it's really just to eliminate confusion. And Section 9 repeals affirmative defense provisions in the CVO law, which is the criminal vehicular operation, that are superseded by the changes already referred to in Section 7. So it kind of cleans it up and makes it all work together again.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Pasiga.
Thank you.
Are there any questions from members of the committee for Mr. Pasiga at this time?
Seeing none. Thank you. We'll ask Senator Champion. Was there anyone else that you intended to have testify?
No one else, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Is there anyone else in the audience that would like to be heard in connection with this bill? Testify for or against. Mr. Watney, come on forward.
This is the bill that was presented to the DWI task force at its last meeting for comment and so on. And there are so many problems with it that its DWI task force postponed any consideration of it until the next meeting in March. When you look through this bill, you will not find a single provision that advances public safety. Mr. Pasiga indicated Minnesota was the first state with an implied consent law. We were not. New York was, 1953. By the time our implied consent law was enacted in 1961, I believe we were number 18. Now, I think it's ever since 1961, we've had a 30-day time period for challenging the revocation. I know at least since 1980 it's been the case. He wishes to double the time to make it in parity with the forfeiture law, which comes later. I'd submit that there is no compelling public policy to doubling the time in which people can challenge the revocation. And if there's some compelling reason to change the time for forfeitures, well, so be it. That might be possible. Minnesota, by having 30 days, is not unusually limited. I believe our neighboring state of North Dakota gives you 15 days in which to challenge an implied consent revocation. So I think it would be bad public policy to go around doubling the revocation, the time for challenging a revocation, solely to make it easier to defend a drunk driver. And likewise, because, as the court indicated in Axelrod, the history of the DWI and implied consent laws are completely different. The purposes are different. The DWI law is to punish conduct. The implied consent law is to protect public safety by taking remedial administrative action. That there are good reasons why there are different affirmative defenses available in one arena and not necessarily in the other. And there is no good compelling argument as to why we should therefore make every affirmative defense that's available in any arena available in every other arena. So I would suggest that is not necessarily a compelling reason to change it. And I had one other thing that I noticed about the giving notice of the affirmative defenses. The proposal here only gives affirmative notice of the affirmative defenses to the prosecutor in the criminal case. Doesn't seem to want to give any notice that they're going to bring up this affirmative defense to the Attorney General's office or the Commissioner of Public Safety in the implied consent case. So there's another technical problem right there. So beyond that, I believe what I mentioned earlier with respect to the other bill covers what I think applies. We basically have a weighing of public interest versus private interest, and the public interest has greater weight and importance, I believe, and therefore these proposals should be rejected.
Thank you, Mr. Watney. Thanks for your testimony. And as to the point about notice, I think that was a drafting oversight, and we're going to have an amendment drafted up to consider when the bill comes back before us. There's already an implied consent petition that a driver or a driver's attorney will file, which is to give notice to the Attorney General's office of what issues are anticipated might be raised in the hearing. And so most lawyers will just add these provisions to their standard petitions. But I think it makes sense to have in statute that the notice is required. So I should ask the Chief Author what you think about that, too, Senator Champion.
Mr. Chair, absolutely. And just a couple of things that I want to say, and I know my testifier wants to deal with some of the specific things that Mr. Watney has brought forth. One is public policy is good public policy when it also provides an opportunity for a person to be heard. There's nothing in this bill that makes it easier for a person to drink and drive. In fact, what it does, it says, hey, if you drink and drive, or if it's alleged that you have the opportunity to be heard so that the trier of fact can consider all of the information and then make a decision as to whether the burdens have been met. And if the burdens have been met, when we think in terms of the implied consent notion, then your license is something that can be taken, or there will be consequences on that end. On the criminal side of the equation, if a person is found to be in violation of the law, their personal liberties can be taken. So there's nothing that would suggest that we are attempting to make it easier for a person to drive drunk. And, in fact, it is the opposite. The notice will also deal with the conduct. So with that being said, I will turn to the testifier, who has a couple other specific things to talk about.
Mr. Pasiga.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, a couple things. With respect to the timing, we're at 30 days, and we seek to move it to 60, and Mr. Watney said, well, that makes it easier for people to fight these things. Under our implied consent law, the timing starts, this 30-day timing right now, or the proposed 60, when they're handed that revocation notice. A driver is given a 7-day temporary license at that point in order to get their affairs in order, and then they begin serving out that revocation. So we revoke first and ask questions later. So giving them an opportunity to have their matter presented to a court, and instead of limiting that window to 30 days and expanding it to 60 like forfeiture, it doesn't get more drunk drivers on the road. All it does is, because they're already revoked and paying their penalty before they ever get a court hearing in most counties, other than Hennepin and Ramsey and a couple others that reinstate if you file a challenge due to some volume concerns and not being able to make our current deadlines work. That's another discussion. But at any rate, generally speaking, people are revoked first and serving out that revocation before they ever even get their implied consent hearing. So this gives them an opportunity to be heard, like has been discussed. Second, Chair Latz referred to, we are required as lawyers when we make these implied consent challenges to file a petition, which includes any issues that we want to have heard at the hearing. So we have to particularize those challenges, and if it's an issue because we think the traffic stop was bad, we have to identify that. If it's post-driving consumption, we have to identify that. If we do not do that, we don't get to raise that issue at the hearing. So the petition already includes the ability for the Attorney General's office, who is our opponent on those cases, to be on notice of what those defenses are. But that being said, it's not too much more trouble for a lawyer to give extra notice of an affirmative defense to the Commissioner of Public Safety, who is representing or is our opponent in these implied consent proceedings. Thank you.
Any further questions from members of the committee for either of the testifiers? Senator Sharon.
Well, I heard you reference who your opponents would be in relationship to these hearings, but I don't see them here talking about their reaction to this proposed change. Have they reviewed it and had input into this process? And then my second question is for the testifier from the task force, DWI task force.
I'm not representing the task force. I attend the meetings.
Oh, I attend the meetings. So have representatives of the task force that are reviewing this are also not here discussing this, and that makes me uncomfortable that I'm not hearing a broader discussion about the bill and its implications.
Senator Sharon, I do believe that the Attorney General's office is aware of the hearing today and that this bill is before us today. And so they can, I guess, choose whether or not they wish to come here to testify for or against any of the changes. But we won't be taking any final action on the bill today, so it'll be another opportunity if they wish to provide the committee with input for them to do so. And I can't speak to the DWI task force's process, but their regulars, they have eyes and ears around the Capitol on a regular basis, and so they are welcome to provide whatever testimony they wish to whenever the bills are before us. Senator Newman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My questions are almost identical to that of Senator Sharon. Other folks that might be involved on this issue would be, say, the criminal defense bar for the Bar Association or the county attorneys or the attorney general's office or the DWI task force. And the question that's revolving around in my mind is, where are they? We have two citizens here testifying to us, albeit very knowledgeable in their respective positions on this bill, but nevertheless, we don't really have any input from anyone other than the two citizens. So I'm just, do you have an explanation, Senator Champion, as to why we have no other groups weighing in on this legislation?
It's big.
Senator Champion.
Mr. Chair, Senator, two things. One, I think our chair has been eloquent in saying that this bill was put on the site. Everyone was notified that these bills were going to be heard. If they make a decision based on their own interests or whether they believe there's anything of consequence in the bill that they should respond to, that they would be here and prepared to testify. Here's the second thing. Our chair has also eloquently articulated that this is not the one and only time that this bill is going to be heard. They are definitely on notice to come forward and talk to me, talk to any of us about what they find good or bad or challenging about this bill or any other bill. The testifier is not here just as a citizen, but he's representing the criminal defense board. Maybe you can tell him a little more about that so that you don't see this only as a citizen who is knowledgeable, but he's also with a larger group or constituency.
Mr. Pasiga.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I am here on behalf of the Minnesota Association of Criminal Defense Lawyers. We are a body of over 200 lawyers specializing in criminal defense, and I am part of their legislative committee, and I was the one selected to speak for our entire organization today.
Senator Newman. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Let me ask the question, Senator Champion, a different way then. Have you had any conversation with any of the players that I have mentioned with respect to this bill?
Senator Newman. No, I have not. I have not talked to the Attorney General's office, for an example. I have had some limited discussion with the city because, in fact, they have a or at least city attorneys have some ADWI bill that is going to be coming forth soon. So there's been some discussions around the Capitol, but not a formal discussion with the Attorney General's office.
Champion, thank you, Mr. Chairman.
And I will note there are several other DWI bills that we will consider as well, including one that does specifically put in place the proposals of the DWI task force that will come before us. And so we'll have an opportunity to inquire of those representatives at that time if you want to have any questions about any topic related to DWI, I suppose. Anyone else in the room wish to be heard with regard to this particular bill, or we'll go ahead and lay it over? All right. Thank you, Senator Champion. Senate File 562 is laid over for possible inclusion in an omnibus DWI bill.
Should ask.
Senator Goodwin. All right. We're going to take up Senate File 570 and then following that 405. I'm sorry, not 405, so just 570.
Even in the beginning?
I have no idea.
Madam Chair.
Senator Latz, Senate File 570.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. Senate File 570 is a proposal that was brought to me by another participant by another criminal defense lawyer other than the person sitting to my left. So I put it into bill form and offered it for consideration by this committee. To set the table briefly, there is a little device called a preliminary screening test or preliminary breath test, sometimes referred to as a PBT, which is referred to in statute in the DWI process. And it is often used by police officers when they are considering whether or not to arrest someone for DWI to get sort of a reference point for what their alcohol concentration might be. It's a roadside test. Often it is it's clearly used after the stop of the vehicle, and sometimes it's used right away. Sometimes it's used after other field sobriety tests have been given. It's for these purposes, always used prior to the arrest, and it will give out a result, 0.08, 0.12, whatever the result turns out to be. Its use is limited by statute, so it cannot be used in the prosecution of the criminal case as part of the jury or the case before the fact finder. The test that's used for that would be the subsequent, more sophisticated breath test, now done by the Data Master machine. Used to be the Intoxilizer. Before that, it was the Breathalyzer. Or if it's not a breath test at that point, a blood or urine test. And those tests are obtained after the arrest, either back at the police station or at a hospital where the blood is drawn. So the preliminary breath test, or the PBT, is used for decisions on whether or not to arrest someone. And the purpose of the bill before you is that usually the police officers do not tell the driver what the results of the PBT were. At any point in the process, even when the driver asks for those results, and the driver may ask for that to help them understand exactly what's going on and make decisions in the course of the DWI processing. So the proposal would obligate the police officer to disclose to the driver the results of the PBT test if the driver asks for it. And in support of this proposal, I have with me defense lawyer Samuel Edmonds. Sam, among other things, was a former prosecuting attorney in Dakota County, now is a defense attorney. He's also here with his colleague, Kevin Sieben, who's in the audience. They practice law together, and I guess somehow between the two of them, they decided which one was going to testify. So I'd ask Mr. Edmonds to be given that opportunity.
Okay. Welcome to the committee, Mr. Evans.
Thank you. Madam Chair, members, thank you for this opportunity to speak. I know the hour is late. I'm going to be very brief. My name is Sam Edmonds. I'm a member of the Minnesota Association of Criminal Defense Lawyers. I sit on the governing council of the Minnesota State Bar Association. As Senator Latz said, I spent about 7 years prosecuting DWI cases, and now I'm a criminal defense and DWI attorney in the community. I speak today only on behalf of myself and my law firm. I'm not here as in a representative capacity for any of the organizations that I mentioned. I would urge this committee to support the proposal. As Mr. Latz said, the preliminary breath test is governed by statute. It can only be used for certain limited purposes. And police officers on our streets around Minnesota use it to determine whether to place an individual under arrest for a suspected DWI or not. It's a small handheld breath test device. Officers carry it in their squad car, and they pull it out on the side of the highway, and somebody blows into this machine. It's widely considered to be not as accurate and reliable as the formal breath test that a person is subjected to later. And that's why this legislature has decided to limit its use in a court of law to very specific purposes. What we find, though, on a day-to-day basis is that as a person is undergoing a DWI arrest, they submit to a preliminary breath test, and then many police officers choose not to disclose the results of the test. The reality is that this handheld machine has a digital readout, and a person blows into it, and the digital screen will say 0.08 or 0.30 or whatever it might be. And we don't know why police officers choose to not disclose those results to the suspected drunk driver. I've had personal experience this with clients undergoing the process. They call me for advice. I even talk to the police officer, and the police officer won't tell me the results of the preliminary breath test. So I'd suggest to this committee that there's no downside to this proposal. This proposal would ensure fairness in the process and transparency in the process. And really where the fairness and transparency are so important is that moment. The suspected drunk driver is brought down to the police station. They are read the implied consent advisory that's set out in statute, and they are told, you have a limited right to consult with an attorney before making a decision about whether you want to submit to a test. That person is given a phone and directories, and they call somebody like me or one of my colleagues, and they look to me for advice on should they submit to this breath test or blood or urine test, and they don't know the answer to that. And one of my first questions to them on the phone would be, well, what was the result of your preliminary breath test? That gives me an idea of what the circumstances are and helps me better advise that person on how they can exercise their rights under the law and what decision they should make. So to require a police officer simply to disclose a two-digit number that they already know about would be very easy for the officer to do. We'd be taking nothing away from police or law enforcement or, you know, the ability to prosecute and enforce the DWI laws. So we're here today to suggest that this is a bill with lots of upside of fairness and accuracy and really no downside. So I'd urge you to support it. I'd be happy to take any questions, and thank you for your time.
Any questions from the members? Senator Newman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. To the testifier, I missed your name.
Edmonds, Samuel Edmonds.
Mr. Edmonds, in the bill under lines 113 and 114, it indicates when the officer doesn't comply, there are certain circumstances under which the test cannot be used. And I'm kind of guessing from the information from Senate Counsel that that would involve license revocation, DWI, and underage drinking issues. We also have in our packet statute which describes the preliminary screening test, and in subdivision 2 of that statute, that's 169A.41, indicates the use of the test results, how we're going to use those.
The question is,
why do we have within this bill, if the police officer fails to provide the test, why do we have a prohibition under 169A.53 rather than a prohibition of the use of the test results under 0.41, which is the statute that creates the test results?
Madam Chair?
Senator Latz.
Senator Newman, on line 14, the bill, it does say 169.8.53 or listed in subdivision 2. So the use is listed in 169.8.41. Subdivision 2 are included in the remedy provision, paragraph C.
So you could use it in either case?
You would not be able to use it if the officer did not provide the information upon as required by paragraph A.
I understand, and it's
in either setting.
In either setting.
Very good. Thank you.
It would apply to both settings.
Very good. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Senator Hall.
Madam Chair, Senator Latz, is there opposition to this from the police department or others?
Senator Latz.
Madam Chair, Senator Hall. I haven't heard anything formal about opposition. No one has come to me and asked to testify on the bill. I think there is some concern from some police officers that they don't want to be required to disclose information. Different police officers or departments have different policies on this. So I'm not aware of any formal position that, say, the police chiefs have taken or the sheriffs have taken.
Senator Hall.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I see someone from State Patrol here. Do they have any comments on this?
Any?
A little bit.
Is there anybody that would like to testify on this? Please state your name for the record.
Chairman, Senator, my name is Shelley Schofer, and I'm the Lieutenant Colonel for the Minnesota State Patrol. And we are aware of this bill. Our policy within the State Patrol, and I'm only speaking for the State Patrol, not for the other law enforcement agencies in the state of Minnesota, is that upon request, the trooper does show the result or give the result. And whether that's happening 100% across the board out in the field in terms of practice, I can't testify to that. I can share some information with you on what I believe is a resistance for some officers to share a result. Typically, when I hear of those situations happening, it's when a PBT result is 0.08 or very close to what the legal limit is. And I think there's a perception from the law enforcement officers that quite possibly if that result is shared that there will be a stalling of the test being administered, the toxilizer test. So that's not something that we train at the State Patrol. It's not a concern of ours. If this bill were to pass in its form, we may very well adopt a policy change that would just require the troopers to display the result to the offender so we've got a video and audio recording of that. That would eliminate the need from us having to appear in court at a later date and trying to prove a negative, so to speak, if an offender said, well, I request the test, and the test result wasn't showed. So, again, I'm speaking just on behalf of the State Patrol, not on behalf of other law enforcement agencies in the state.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Any other questions, members? Thank you for your testimony. Please sign in. And any final words, Senator Latz?
Well, I'm going to ask to have this laid over as well for possible inclusion. And I will note there was a comment that was made earlier that that a lot of these bills today are not intended to advance public safety or don't have the effect of advancing public safety. And I think what you're seeing here is that there's some additional attention being focused on the rights of people that are going through the process. Defending against criminal charges. And I think as you'll see, as we work our way through other DWI bills, that there will be additional focus on specifically advancing public safety concerns as well. And I think what you'll end up with at the in the final analysis is a pretty fairly balanced proposal to address some issues that have been coming up over the course of time and suggestions. And the committee, I think, should have an opportunity to weigh them and to think about them and decide where to go with them. And so with that stated as sort of a broad, overarching closing comment, Madam Chair, I ask that Senate Files 570 be laid over for possible inclusion in an omnibus bill.
Okay. All in favor, aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Okay. The bill will be laid over for potential inclusion in the DWI omnibus bill. Senator Latz, would you like me to announce next week, or are you going to come up and do that yourself?
You can go ahead and do it.
All right. Thank you. Next Tuesday, we'll have a hearing on a number of bills, and the members have been emailed the agenda. I'm sure others can find it on the site, the Senate site. And then Thursday, we will be doing voting restoration, felony voting bill, and body camera regulation. And with that, meeting is adjourned.
Madam Chair, next Thursday you should probably anticipate going past the hour and a half.
Okay.
Committee time, given the
yes,
given the
Senator
two
Latz
bills
said,
that are on the agenda.
Yes, we can anticipate going longer a week from today.
Because my friend is not going to ask questions. I know that.